Welcome to the Connect You podcast, where we interview guests who have transformed their lives, whether in mind, body, health, or wealth. Connect You seeks to discover what drives people and makes them extraordinary. Brought to you by Lewis Jackson, who brings you exciting real-life stories, hot topics, and the truth.
On today's episode, we have Lewis Crompton, who helps people become happier, healthier, and wealthier through investing. And we're going to deep dive into that, but I'm not going to tell you how. We're going to let Lewis tell you that. And it's going to be a lot of failures along the way. We're going to tell you the ups and the downs. But Lewis, welcome to the show, and thank you very much for coming on.
Thank you for having me. Good to be here.
So, turning back to the very beginning, I'd like to start these podcasts and these episodes, wherever you're listening, at the beginning. As it always does. So, why did you? What was it like growing up first?
Oh, we're going right back to the
beginning. I want to know what it was like for you, because I've done my own research, and I understand it wasn't the greatest for you.
Yeah.
Growing up.
Yeah. So, it's a tricky one to kind of. Explain, because actually I had an amazing childhood. My parents are incredible, they're wonderful, lovely people, but no matter how wonderful your parents are, they can't necessarily protect you from everything that there is that's out there. So my childhood started out fairly not the way you would want a kid's childhood to start out. So so without going into too much detail, you can see I'm stumbling over my words, so I never quite know how to say it, but I experienced abuse as a child. Not from my parents, from external to my family. But it wasn't until I was an adult that I actually realised that had happened. So lots of my struggle, lots of my difficulty and my rebellion or I actually hated my parents, to be honest. Well, more my dad, because we just, males and males often clash that way, don't they? But a lot of that was just rooted in dealing with this, well, these situations that happened to me in my childhood that I was not aware it had even happened until I was an adult. And people say, well, how did you not know until you were an adult? Because the brain is an absolutely wonderful, fantastic, miraculous thing that when people go through incredible difficulty and trauma, I find trauma absolutely fascinating and the body and the brain's response to it. But one of the coping mechanisms that the brain can employ is it dissociates. So it disconnects itself from the situation, and those memories that are created within that dissociation moment go into like a secret folder in the brain.
Yeah.
And that secret folder I didn't have access to until I was an adult. And it was when I was about 18, I was training myself to become a counsellor, a therapist for other people. And one of the things we had to do in that process of training is we had to fill in a form, which is what we would give to our potential, I suppose, clients or... So I'm trying to think of the other word for client. What is it if you go to the doctors? What are you there? Patient.
Patient.
But it wasn't medical enough to consider them a patient of mine.
Yeah.
So they were definitely a client. And the form basically that I filled in, I was going through my answers and they were going through them with us in this like training room. They were saying, if you've answered these types of questions in this type of way, or if your client does, then this is suggesting that they've had this or this happen to them in their childhood. And I just sat there very quietly and think, oh dear. I'm showing all these signs of somebody who's experienced abuse in their childhood. And up until that point, I had no idea. And then after that is when it all started to come out.
So... Was it physical abuse or was it verbal? Because I can certainly relate to what you're saying. And I've never said this on camera either. It's certainly with my dad as well. And it's very... It's the first time that anyone's ever said that. And funny enough, I took exactly the same journey. I went to become a support worker.
Mm-hmm.
And that unlocked something and I thought, you know what? It's got a capped salary, and that's why I just went, you know what, I can't do it anymore.
Yeah.
Because I can't make the difference I'm going to make.
Yeah.
And then I sort of went, nope, can't do that, I'm going to park it to one side, and I can create more impact, if you will, through doing what I'm doing now,
yeah.
and I've got more reach.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I mean, I'll expand on that once, obviously, you can, if you're willing to share. I mean, was it physical? Was it verbal?
Yeah, so abuse is a very catch-all term, isn't it, really?
Yeah.
I would just say my parents weren't abusive to me. My dad has his own whatever and did have a bit of a temper, but that would never go over the top in terms of a physical thing. But I did grow up in a household where I was nervous a lot of the time because of his anger. But now he's great, love him to pieces, and he's chilled out a lot now he's retired. but the abuse that I experienced outside of that context, outside of the family unit, was predominantly of a sexual nature. So that was, very, very hard to grasp and understand. And even the as an adult, becoming aware that had happened and the memories that then started to come out of that secret folder became intrusive. And so I went through a very difficult time of these memories coming back. I was very heavily involved in church, and it was often in times of worship, so music and singing, or just resting in music and basically meditating. When I would quieten down my brain, meditate basically, that's when they would start to come out. And I would suddenly think, what is this? And I'd feel awful about it. And I've started having dreams about awful things and stuff like that. And so it was only when I went into therapy myself that they started to come out in a way which I could actually process and deal with and handle and work through. But it was quite surreal reading a book once about trauma and this type of trauma and how many of my issues were just tick box for every single thing that happened to me, or rather everything that happened to me, all my behaviours as a consequence of that form of abuse just nailed me to the wall. I was like, that's exactly why I struggle with this, why I struggle with that, why I don't have boundaries, why I struggle to feel connected and loved within my own family. And I remember when I was in therapy once, I don't know if I've even told my parents this, so hopefully they don't watch this, but one of the reasons I had so much anger towards my parents growing up, but I didn't know why, and I wanted nothing to do with them, I didn't want to connect with them, is because I had this memory come back during therapy where my parents welcomed in to the house one of these men that had abused me. And so I remember being logical as a child in this memory, thinking, but you're meant to be my parents, you're not meant to protect me, but you're welcoming in the person who's abusing me. And so that caused a massive disconnect as a child towards my sense of trust within my relationship with my parents. And so that's put a massive strain in that relationship for many, many years, many, many years, probably up until about 5-6 years ago.
And it's, and you mentioned boundaries there. There's so many ways that I could take that. With the podcast on just trauma alone.
Yeah.
And what it's labelled as and what you was labelled as. And because you could have been given a name as depressed. You could, and I'm sure you was at some point.
Yeah.
Again, it's something I can certainly resonate with as well that you touched on was sitting alone with your thoughts.
Yeah.
Even to this day now, I sometimes am guilty of, and I'm sure a lot of other people while that are listening, if I'm sat alone, and it's something I still struggle with, as I mentioned, that my mind will go 100 miles an hour, and then thoughts come back, because as I mentioned in the previous podcast, that I was previously sectioned for reactive depression.
Mm-hmm.
I wasn't depressed, it was something that occurred, and it reactively I went off the radar. But there's these labels that I don't necessarily agree with.
Mm-hmm.
But what was your coping mechanism at the time?
Really interesting question, because it was different for me than a lot of people.
Mm.
So the way, and again, coping mechanism without knowing that I was trying to cope. So growing up, so I became very, very religious, very, very spiritual. And the reason I did that, again, it's actually textbook if you look at what trauma does to you. Because I needed to have black and white. That's the only way I could operate and feel safe in my own brain, is to have black and white. So picking religion, for me it was Christianity, and I still consider myself spiritual, I believe in something greater than just us. But picking that and going so hard into that world was my coping mechanism. and it became my family. So I didn't need to be with my own family. I would sacrifice family birthdays and important family things for the sake of being at church. That is where I coped, and I kept myself busy, and I kept my brain in black and white, this or that, because that's what allowed me to feel safe.
Do you still do that now with your business?
Yes. Yeah, I think I do. Although it's harder to, because there isn't a lot of black or white.
No, I we will touch on it, because I certainly do. And I think if people are honest with themselves, they do as well. Anyone that's had success and failed, because that's important, failure is important, and you've got to learn from that. It's certainly something, because I can certainly resonate with what you're saying. I've been there.
Yeah.
Not exactly what you've done, but certainly been through the process of it. But I can certainly resonate with, yeah, the faults, then going through that, like I say, the process. And, yeah, it hit home when you said about that. And I just think that it's important to go sit alone with your thoughts and then 100 miles an hour, and then we've got to learn that process of coping with that.
Oh, you do. And I think if whether you know you're trying to avoid your feelings and your thoughts, or whether you don't know, the behaviour is the same. It's avoidance. And so you will keep yourself super busy, or you'll become an experience junkie like I did, and I started travelling the world. Always said that's what I wanted to do, and I do love travelling. But when you're constantly travelling, constantly, and I travel so much, I gave myself chronic fatigue symptoms because I was trying to escape that much. It's not healthy. It's just not. It's also not real life. And one of, I don't know if people listening to this podcast like Jordan Peterson, but some of the stuff he says I really like. And one of the things he says is that normal life is not sipping pina coladas by the beach. Normal life is the day-to-day, and it's a bit mundane. But I was so working so hard, and probably the thing which attracted me first to trading is I could make money for 30 minutes a day, and I could travel the world and be anywhere. And so that's what I did. That's what I made happen. So I traded for 30 minutes a day, and then I would go out and get pissed up in Singapore or get pissed up in Hong Kong or wherever it was that I was in the world. And amazing, amazing times, but only for so long.
Yeah.
And there's only so long you can try to outrun your demons, for lack of a better word, before they catch up with you. And when they caught up with me, my God, did it hit hard.
Why?
Well, part of the reason my demons caught up with me is because I end up in a relationship, which was a very toxic one. Again, tick that box for ending up in a toxic relationship when you've had certain things happen to you. And when that relationship fell apart, well, I ended up...
Was that because you didn't have boundaries?
Yeah, yeah. Well, I didn't... Yes, I didn't have boundaries, but that specifically, I didn't have boundaries or a framework of how someone I'm in an intimate relationship with should treat me. Because I was super Christian, I'd never had an adult sexual relationship. So I was a virgin until I was 26 because I was on this track to only have sex when you're married, and that's, again, that's black and white, that's safety. So I didn't have to ever give my body to someone, which had been prior abused. So I didn't like my own body, I didn't feel like my body was my own. So that was safe because I didn't have to give my body to anybody.
Yeah.
And so when I kind of realised, well, actually, I'm not going to be waiting until I'm married, and actually I don't know if my sexuality even aligns with that part of Christianity either, it became a very, very difficult thing. So that's when I end up in a relationship, end up in a sexual relationship, and when that broke down, because I realised it wasn't a healthy relationship, and it dragged on for about 3 years after that, that's when it really hit the fan for me, because all my coping mechanisms that I'd been using for 26 years suddenly were broken because of the pain caused by that relationship. So all my internal coping mechanisms were now gone, and I had nothing left.
So now you have to rebuild.
I had to rebuild. And this is where I'm so passionate, partly about trading, because if I didn't have trading at that point, I don't know how I would have coped on a financial level. Because I was able to pull myself together for 30 minutes a day, do what I needed to do. I was still able to travel, which allowed me a bit of escapism, but it was good escapism at that point because it got me out of my rut. And there was other days where I couldn't get out of bed, like genuinely. I remember I was living in Watford at the time, flat sharing with a friend of mine, And I remember getting into the car park just outside the flat and thinking I was about to have a mental breakdown. Like, to the point, I don't know if you've ever been to that point where you think your brain is about to snap. And I, thankfully it didn't, but I was like, I'm that close. And I was in therapy 3 times a week at that point. But I remember speaking to one of my mentors at the time, and he said, and I was moaning about how much I was spending on therapy. He's like, Lewis, what are you moaning about? You obviously need it, and you're in a position where you can afford it. I was like, oh yeah, that's true. So again, just reframed that, but yeah.
What sort of therapy was it?
So that one was psychotherapy. I don't really know what that means, to be honest, but...
Well, obviously, I want to touch on it because, like I said, I do know what that means. And when the brain's about to snap, like I say, well, I was actually put into... well, I was actually sectioned from my own mental health, not anyone else's, but I didn't have a clue where I was.
Yeah.
Literally, as you said there, yeah. I felt like I was about to just burst.
Yeah.
It was reactive, but at the same time, it wasn't healthy for anyone because I was just walking around like a zombie.
Yeah.
And when you get to the point of burnout, as you mentioned earlier, that's all you can literally do is just keep going and going and going until your body just fails.
Yeah.
And it's not good for the people around you that love you.
No.
And it's not. And you just, because you can't see a way out, you're escaping and not dealing and coping with whatever it is. But therapy obviously helped you.
It did, yeah.
What were some of the things that you learned within therapy?
I always have to leave with the same takeaway. Because I still go to therapy, not as much, I don't need it as much anymore, but I still believe in keeping going. One of the things I always leave with is be kind to yourself. I'm terrible at that. I still am terrible at that. Mm. But be kind to yourself. It's so, so important. But beyond just being kind to yourself in terms of like the well-known phrase or whatever, but what does that actually mean and how does that actually manifest on a daily basis in your actions and your activity? So what I constantly will work myself to the point of exhaustion. That's not being kind to myself. Okay, I may achieve certain things as a result of that, but I think I've become less focused on achieving something ridiculously amazing and all of that. I'd rather be happy and healthy and love the people I'm with. So being kind to myself and realizing what I do today makes an impact tomorrow with my eating habits, because my eating habits get very out of hand as well.
Again, you love Chinese.
Ah, bloody love Chinese. Yeah. Honestly, like I can easily go 3-4 times a week for Chinese. I love it. Absolutely love it. But it's not healthy. And so you can say, oh, it's self-love, I'm giving myself a treat. Well, no, you're not. You're actually damaging yourself. You're under the guise of self-love.
Yeah.
So that's a lot of lessons I've had to learn as well. And that's where I think investing is so interesting, because it is a form of self-love. Like, I'm putting this away for the benefit of the future. Like, that's a massive act of self-love. And often it can, well, with property at least, it comes with a bit of sacrifice. Because, yeah. So I often leave therapy sessions with be kind to yourself. That's one of the major ones. Communication is very, very important. You can communicate what you want to people, and if they don't want to match that, or if they've got desires that you can't match, then it's okay to walk away. That was a really important one. Realizing other people's, the impact of stuff that's happened to me on other people as well. For example, when I shared with my parents about what had happened to me and they really struggled to come to terms with it or to even believe it, not getting upset that they were like not believing me, but just realizing, well, their own brains have to go on a process of coming to terms with that and figuring out what that means for them and all of that sort of stuff, and giving them space in order to do that too. So I think I give a lot of people a lot more space than I used to. I think I was very emotionally dead before I went through all of this stuff. And it wasn't that I was dead, it's just I was in such coping mechanism mode.
Detached.
Yeah, that I was just constantly detached. Whereas now I've probably cried 4 times this week just watching the TV. It's brilliant.
So how that, what you've just said there, was what my ex-wife said to me.
Mm-hmm.
You're emotionally not even on the planet, because I don't... well, I don't show emotion at all, apart from to my kids.
Mm-hmm.
So I've got 3 beautiful kids. Love them to pieces. The only thing that I would show emotion to is my children.
Yeah.
If I earn a certain amount of money, not fast, I'll reinvest. Again, the only thing is my children that would make me happy. Money, not necessarily, because I know you can, it comes and goes.
Yeah.
What changed for you to make that it more connection, I suppose, with showing emotion?
Yeah, I think, and again, maybe this is just where therapy has helped me, but what I went through disconnected me from people. Mm. It disconnected me from myself. I'm debating telling a particular story here. Do not sod it, I'm open, but like I said. So one of the things that abuse can do is it makes you not feel like you own your own body. And I can't believe I'm about to tell this story, but anyway, hopefully it will help someone. And I remember this one point, I was, let's say, feeling myself, and I remember being in Switzerland, not that that makes much difference to the story, in a hotel, and I was basically masturbating, there we go, I've said it. And I suddenly felt ownership of my body. And it was the first time, and I was probably in my early 20s, I was probably like 22, 23, and it was the first time I felt like I owned my body.
Yeah.
And I've spoken to people who've been through similar things who are a lot older. I remember speaking to this lady, and I won't say where she is because it might identify her, but she'll know who she is. And she was married with kids, and she'd never had an orgasm. And it was only in her late 50s that she started to actually experience and take ownership of her own body that she finally had an orgasm. And seems very off-piste from what we're talking about, but again, a bit of self-love goes a long way.
It does.
But for me, it was about connection. I wasn't connected internally to myself. I wasn't connected to my own body. I wasn't connected to my own emotions because everything was disconnected because I had to be so, this is this and that is that, to survive. Didn't realise that's what I was doing, but that's what I was doing to just try and survive and get through the days, that any time I would feel emotion, I would push it down. And since going through having all my coping mechanisms destroyed and having to rebuild new ones, they're healthier. I'm not saying they're all healthy, I've definitely still got a way to go, but it allowed me to start feeling again. And connection with my parents is so much better. I'm now in a relationship which is a very healthy relationship, annoyingly healthy. I'm definitely the unhealthy one in my relationship now. And that all of those things have given me space to be brave, and by that I just mean let myself feel. And it's not always comfortable. It's really not always comfortable. And now, unfortunately, because I feel, I also do have depression every now and then. I also can get hit pretty hard with anxiety. But I would rather have those feelings than go back to what I used to have, which is nothing at all.
And the reason I asked the question the way I did was my ex-wife used to say that I had this,
mm-hmm.
was because I had no ownership.
And okay.
It was exactly that. So now, it's going to sound horrible, but I'll just be blunt, which I am, as people will know, and you'll probably gather that. It's not that I don't care about what she's feeling, I don't care of the opinion if I don't believe it to be true.
Mm-hmm.
So now I take full ownership of any responsibility, but at the time I didn't. Like mm-hmm. you've just said there, I'm in control of what I'm doing.
Yeah.
To the best of my ability. So as everyone knows, I've got epilepsy. That's not something I can control, but I'm not going to let that ruin my life.
Yeah.
Simple things like picking medication up. I'd allow Gemma to do that. Now that's mine. If I don't pick medicine up, I won't be living the next week. So if I don't take that, I'm at risk of SUDEP, which is sudden unexplained death in epilepsy. I die. So I will take full responsibility for picking that up.
Mm-hmm.
Again, relationships. If I want to make that work, we connect, there's a deeper connection there. I have to put the effort in to make that work.
Mm-hmm.
If I don't, there's not a connection there. Breakdown in communication, even in business relationships, that's on me. So it always comes down to being happy.
Yeah.
Again, if you're happy, everything will be better.
It will be better, but I think from what you've just said there, my question to you would be, but where does that leave space for other people? Because there is a certain level of reliance on other people which allows you to have that connection. Because I was fiercely independent. I would, from very, very young.
Oh no, more people that come in my life, the better.
Yeah, yeah.
100%. So again, I'll use my ex-wife as an example. More than welcome to come in my life. However, what I would have now is boundaries.
Yeah, yeah.
Like what you said now, is I didn't know what the boundary was, because there's a line that you wouldn't necessarily want to cross.
But sometimes the only way you know it's a barrier is when you break it once.
You have to break it. We did. And then I ended up with a son. And you go, okay, I've crossed the line. and then you learn, you fail, and you learn again, same in business. And at that point, you think, no, I can't go that far again, but we push and push and push until you realise there's the line.
Mm-hmm.
More people in my life, the better, because that's how you grow.
Yeah.
You grow as an individual, you grow in the business.
Yeah.
It's the same in any aspect of life. You have to figure out where that line is. And there's no right or wrong.
Mm.
And that's what people got to realise. You are who you are. You've just got to keep going day by day.
Yeah.
And that's my outlook on it. If you haven't yet, and I've never met a person sat in a chair or on a Zoom and done a podcast that has full control and that's never suffered with a form of anxiety or type of depression that runs a business or works full time, in my experience.
And I think it's a good sign that you care.
100%.
And I think if you are into business, you have a certain element of you which is a bit of a control freak, but you're going into a world where you don't have that much control.
Mm.
Like, there's definitely things you can control, and you can behave this way, behave that way, do this and do that, but you still don't necessarily have a control over the outcome of it. You're going, it is an anxiety-inducing place to be because you don't have control over it. Or let's take anxiety out of the equation, it's a stressful position to put yourself into. And I do think some people are more emotional naturally than others, and some people are less emotional naturally. Again, like you said, it's okay either way. You just have to be true to who you are and continue operating in that way. But then also be aware of the people in your life and how they operate, because they're not always the same as you.
No, I completely agree with that. I mean, so what I'm talking about now is your business.
Yeah.
I understand from obviously doing my own research about yourself, and obviously knowing you a little bit about yourself, you appreciate the value and the cost of stuff.
Yes.
Not just the cost of items,
mm-hmm.
but the value of obviously things that matter to you is in the connection as well. But explain what that means to you, value and cost.
So cost is just how much something costs. Like for me, if you go and, let me put it into my favourite thing, Chinese takeaway. So I love a Chinese takeaway. The cost of a Chinese takeaway that I tend to get is probably about 40 quid because I order too much. But it lasts me at least two meals, so it's all good. So it cost me £20 per meal, £40 for the takeaway, right? That's the cost. But what value is that £40 adding to my life? Is it giving me joy? 100%. Is it giving me £40 worth of joy, though? That's up to me to decide. It's saving me the hassle of having to cook, so it's saving me some time. Probably for two meals worth of time. So is that worth £40? Is it adding £40 worth of health to my life? Probably not. So the cost and the value are two different things. Value is what it actually adds to you. Cost is just the price. It's just what you've paid. So taking that back into my business, if someone pays me for mentorship or education, the price of that, the investment in that, is what it costs, but the value that that adds to them for the rest of their life should be way more than what they pay me. And that's always the goal, and it is. That is why we do what we do, is so that we can add value and improve people's lives for the better.
And then obviously, but you had to initially invest yourself to learn. What people may not know about yourself is that you've obviously had to invest into this yourself. You didn't get a free ride. You've heavily educated yourself.
Yeah.
And obviously you've spoken on stage in front of thousands and thousands of people.
Yeah.
Even though you've openly admitted yourself with anxiety as well. So tell me more about how much you've invested in yourself, you've educated yourself, and obviously you was working full time as well.
Yeah.
In a job you didn't really want to be working at.
Yeah.
So tell me more about that.
So when I first started looking at investing, it's because I was working retail. I started on the shop floor for Better Menswear, and I worked my way up, always been a hard worker, and also in retail it's not that hard to progress if you want to. So I worked my way up into head offices, and I started doing distribution and logistics, and then my manager was a bit of a bitch, and I couldn't moan to her manager because her manager and her were best friends and was also a bitch. So I was like, you know, I'll solve this, so I'll just move departments. So then I moved over to merchandising, And I enjoyed it because I enjoyed the people I worked with. I've always been people orientated. And I just realised one day, I looked at my boss's boss's boss, who's probably about 60k a year, something like that. And I was like, that's not what I want to be on for the rest of my life. And even if I change company, I'll just be doing the same shit with a different shovel. I was like, I'm going to get so bored.
Yeah.
But I need a bit more stimulation than that for the rest of my life. And so I decided to start looking at investing because of that. I just didn't want to be a desk junkie. I had a career path, but it wasn't a career path that led anywhere that I really wanted it to go. And would never give me what I really wanted from life, which is when I did have kids. I've always wanted kids, don't have them yet. But when I do have kids, I want to be able to spend time with them. I don't want to be trapped having to go to the office and things like that. So investment was obviously the way forward. So initially I thought that was going to be property. So friends of mine told me about a book called Rich Dad Poor Dad by Robert Kiyosaki, I'm sure most people know, and I decided to buy the book, but I ended up not buying the book, but I saw an advert in the metro when I was on the train one day commuting to work about a seminar he was doing in London. Well, I say he was doing, he wasn't, someone on his behalf. So I turned up to the Bloomsbury Theatre on a Saturday afternoon, Bloomsbury Theatre, Bloomsbury Hotel in Tottenham Court Road, and a man named Nick was speaking, became a friend of mine. And I actually signed up for the wrong event. So I thought I'd signed up for the property event. I hadn't. I signed up for the trading event, so financial market trading. And Nick was talking on that. And so I just signed up for it, basically. I was completely sold. I could travel the world. I could make money anywhere. I could do it with not that much time involved. And they didn't say 30 minutes a day. That was what I developed later on. And so I did a three-day weekend, and on that three-day weekend, it was just a sales pitch, really, to a full-on course. So I did the full-on course, and that cost me half of my annual salary at the time. Well, actually, just over half my annual salary to do that training. And so I asked my dad if I could borrow some money. He said no. Said I was crazy. I went, probably am, but I need to do this. So I took out a credit card and a personal loan, which I think I was paying 15.4% on or something ridiculous like that, so I could start my journey of becoming a trader. And so I remember I went home after dropping that money, crapped my pants, and then I just wrote a sign which said, I am now a trader, and I put it on my wall. And so then every morning from then on, I would get up a little bit earlier than I had to before going to work, and I would start learning and going through this process and this method to become a trader. And then 7 months after that, left my job and started travelling and trading full time. So yeah, that's what I did then.
And from that, so 7 months you've left.
Yeah.
And then what's happened?
So from then, about 6 months after that, they asked me to come back and do a testimonial for Rich Dad. So I said, yeah, okay. And then at that point, they realised I was good at speaking in front of people. So they said, would you like to come and teach on behalf of us? I was like, sure. So I started teaching for them. And as I travelled, I would stop off at different events that they had going on, and I would speak and teach at different places they had going on. And then about 2 years after that, I had met a load of property investors through that network, and so I decided to get involved on the property side as well. So I started taking my profits from trading, investing them into property instead. I've never been that flashy a person. I mean, I know I'm wearing a Rolex now, but it's got to be done, doesn't it? It's got to be done.
So I'll say with Casio, mate.
But you know what? Retro. Honestly, I bought a couple of them, and as much as I love them, I just sit there thinking, what's the point? Like, I'd rather buy another property, to be honest. Like, I could sell my yeah. watches and buy a couple of houses. Like, why? Yes, okay, it's an asset over time. That's something we say to legitimise buying them. The reality is,
I'm going to hold this, but yeah. I could buy a house.
Yeah, I'm going to hold it, so it's going to go up in value. Okay, but is it going to go up in line with inflation? And even if it does go up greater than inflation, how much is inflation actually eating away at that growth anyway?
Yeah.
Whereas, why wouldn't I buy a cash-flowing living right. asset? So I call things like Rolexes now dead assets, whereas I call like property a living asset. And I know someone out there is going to steal that as a concept for themselves, but anyway, you heard it here first. So I'd rather buy properties now. So property journey probably started about 7-8 years ago, maybe 6-7 years ago. And then I got investors on board. So again, that happened because I had success from trading and people were wanting to give me money to trade with for them, but I've never felt comfortable doing that. I like using my own money. I don't like the added pressure of other people's money. So I said, you can give me your money, but I'm not going to trade with it, but I'll use it for property investment. So that's what I did. And so I built three property companies, realised I hated having three property companies, so I sold two of them and went down to one property company. I just wanted to keep it simple. And now I'm paying off, and I know a lot of property people hate this, but I'm paying off mortgage debt, and then I'm going to buy in cash going forward.
That's interesting you say that, and I know property people hate that.
They do hate that, yeah. I get grief given to me online when I say it.
So I'm going to touch on the obviously the education part, but you've previously done a video on this, and I want to ask you, why are property gurus wrong?
About which bit? They're wrong on various things.
You can explain all you like. you just go all out, mate.
Yeah.
I love it.
So
I love the video, but I just want you to go all out as much as you want.
So
I agree with you.
Yeah, yeah. One thing for me is property gurus go through cycles where they're right and then they're wrong. And often it's to do with the timing factor that they're wrong. They're giving the wrong advice or the right advice at the wrong time. So for me, right now, you shouldn't be investing in a way which is highly leveraged, in my opinion. Now, that's not fear-mongering, that's just reading things as it is. Why would you not protect yourself? I also think that the nature of anything online is it's fairly catch-all, which means it's fairly bland, or rather it's fairly generic advice. And a lot of people will not feel comfortable with operating in a certain way within property. Most of the people I know who were highly, highly leveraged back in 2007 and 2008, they're the ones who got screwed over. Those who were at lower gearing, they're the ones who survived through that process. I was speaking to someone who runs a global business the other day about the recession, and one of the really interesting things that they were saying is that they were like, well, I've lived through four recessions already. This is very, very different to other recessions, because a lot of the previous recessions were about spending getting out of hand, people having far too much disposable income, and therefore the system was just not operating the way that it should. And so things had to come in to balance that. Right now, the reason we're going into recession isn't because we have too much demand, it's because we don't have enough supply. There's a big difference in what happens when that's the case. So they were saying it may not get as bad as it has done prior in previous recessions, but it will still be difficult, and it might be an elongated difficult period. But for me, again, my thing is about building financial stability and financial peace for people. If you're constantly geared as far up as you can be geared, and you're only paying interest, when does it end? And I also am never going to believe that property prices double every 10 years. Where are you buying? Where are you buying? Maybe in London, but even double. That's a big statement to say. All the statistics, I'm not buying into those statistics, I'm afraid. And especially where I buy in the northeast, really, really great yields, but I ain't getting double in property prices in 10 years. So why would I buy everything just on interest only? That for me, that's not a long-term strategy. Surely the long-term strategy should be, if you don't need the money as well, like I'm not trying to live off of property income. So if I don't need that money, why would I not be buying back my risk every single month by doing capital repayments? Surely that's a more sensible process to be going on. And when I think about being able to leave my kids something, why would I not rather leave them a cash asset rather than a debted asset? For the sake of what? Ego? So I can grow faster, so I can have more property? Great. For me, it's the same thing as well. Turnover is vanity, profit is sanity. Same thing.
It's such an important saying that, because the amount of people that are selling their assets or their whole portfolios. Just look at the market now.
Yeah.
People that can't sell them.
Yeah.
They're reducing the prices. It's such an important fact that you've just mentioned there. I've got so many properties that have been offered to me off market. Can you take it off? We'll sell it at a discounted rate. No.
Yeah.
I don't want it, because you have to sell it at X, because you're leveraged so far.
Yeah.
Basically leveraged to the eyeballs. I'm not going to pay that. Because it's just not worth it. And they're all over the country. It's just pretty much exactly what you've just touched on.
Because things go wrong. Where's your safety net?
And these are experienced people. They've got a lot of properties in their portfolio. And if you don't mitigate the risks, it will go wrong.
Yeah.
And this is what people have got to understand. It doesn't matter whether you're trading, whether you invest in property. OK, property's known as one of the safer investments, but that can still go wrong.
Yeah.
You can still lose money by doing that.
Yeah.
I want to make that very clear. I've made it clear before. It doesn't matter what you invest in unless you educate yourself.
Mm-hmm.
You've got to educate yourself, which brings me back to what you've done. You didn't just educate yourself. You spent 7 months fine-tuning the craft. But I get the impression you didn't just spend 7 months doing a little bit in the morning. Just walk me through the process, because I can imagine you sitting there learning. Walk me through that, because in my head I've got this impression you're sitting there every morning going, right, that's not right, that's not right, that's not right, but bang, we're going to get this, we're going to nail this down.
Yeah.
I can imagine that's you, very articulate.
Yeah, so let me kind of talk about the process I take my students on, because it's exactly the same as what I did.
Okay.
So what we do with people is we have a very particular set of skills. I will find to just trap myself in the head.
Do it.
Yeah, so we have a very particular set of skills, and the process of mastering those skills is a simple one, but it does take work.
Yeah.
And we keep it simple intentionally, because most of my students are property investors. Mm. Most of my students are either running businesses or also have families, so they want to make an additional income stream, but they don't want to spend loads of time doing it. So in your learning phase, you do want to spend more than 30 minutes if you can on a daily basis, but honestly, an hour is enough. 2 hours is brilliant, but you don't have to do that if you can't do that. And what we're doing is we're testing the patterns that we apply to the markets. So we are pattern-based traders. We're what's called swing traders. So we're looking at daily charts. So a daily chart means that every candle, if you don't know what a candle is, it's a summary of the data from a particular time frame. That candle on the daily chart is worth 1 day's worth of data. So we're looking for patterns across that image that we're seeing in the market. So what we're doing on a day-to-day basis in our learning phase is we're mastering the ability to identify those patterns when they occur in the market, because they very, very rarely look textbook. So we need to learn to identify them. We're learning to identify where the resistance areas are, where the support areas are, and all that really means is we're looking to be able to identify where the market responds on a repeated basis at certain levels. So that's all that means. So we just need to make sure we're practicing and applying that skill correctly. So what my students do is every single day they're working through our content, which teaches them how to apply that, teaches them how to identify that, and then we review that with them if they're part of our mentorship program to make sure they're applying it all correctly. So once they've mastered our patterns, then they can master going live as well. And we talk about 5 different areas of mastery. So on we call it the star trading method. So it's 5-pointed star. I'm trying to remember what they all are now. I do remember. I will remember. So the first one is mastering the markets. So what is the market telling you? The second one is mastering your risk, so protecting your money. Like, we only ever risk a really low amount, so we risk 1% of our account, which is why I personally believe trading is a lower risk than property investment, because I've lost a heck of a lot more in property than I ever did trading.
How much have you lost in property?
On one deal?
In total.
Oh, in total? Flipping heck. Over 50k, which isn't big compared to some people. But my portfolio is not that. Well, 30k was one deal, which was a flip, which we bought the week before COVID lockdowns happened.
Yeah, no one could predict that.
No, but I should have trusted my gut instinct on that one, because I was working with a business partner who was saying these are what the numbers are. He'd done flips in the area before, and they'd been successful, but I just didn't. You know, when I looked at the numbers and I was like, I'm not sure that's what we're going to get for it. But I trusted his experience, and I shouldn't have done. But that wasn't the reason why we lost as much as we did. Like, if it had sold for what it should have sold for, we would have broken even. If it sold for what he was saying it would have sold for, then we would have made 30k profit. But based on what my figures said, we would have been break even. But then, yeah, we just had various things. The costs went through the roof because of
course.
Yeah, we had to pay an extra 7 grand to together. Who are scumbags and I will never work with ever again, who denied that COVID was a reason why my build project might have been delayed a little bit. Yeah, that's legit why they charged us an extra year's worth of fees on top of, because they said COVID was not a reason why our build was delayed. So yeah, I'll never work with them again. Yeah, and then the week before we completed on that property, the vendor, this is the second vendor, by the way, the first one pulled out because of COVID. The second vendor, not vendor, purchaser, she decided that she wanted 10 grand off the purchase price, otherwise she wasn't going to complete.
So they didn't. Oh, wow.
Yeah. So you know when you, I was at that
probably
point.
Probably stressful.
Yeah. I was at breaking point. I was like, do you know what? Off you.
Yeah.
I'm done with you.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I considered writing a very strongly worded letter, and I was like, no, just move on with your life.
Yeah. No. And what about trading? How much have we lost in trading?
Nothing. I mean, I have trades where I lose,
yeah.
But on a, I mean, yeah, on say an annual basis, because we talk about property annually. If we talk about trading annually, I've never been in a negative position trading annually.
And that's because you've managed it?
Yeah, it's because we're aiming to make 2%, 5%, 10% profit per month off of our account. So you have a lot of wiggle room there. But we manage our risk down, so we only are risking 1% of our account per trade. But we could make 1% back, 2% back, 5% back. One of my students made 7% off of one trade the other day. So, yeah. Yeah,
and people listening won't, they'll look at that and go, that's not a lot of money, but it depends what your...
Depends what your account is, yeah.
Exactly that.
Yeah. And this is what I always say to people, you have to focus on the ROI.
Yeah.
Because what's a good ROI in property on an annual basis? I don't know, maybe 20%, should we say?
Yeah.
So...
But that's what I work with.
Yeah, yeah. Whereas a lot of people in property will work on 10% and they're really happy with that. So if you're trading and you're only making 20% per year, then you're doing something wrong, in my opinion. Like, absolute lowball figure is 2% per month, and that is 26% a year compounded.
Yeah.
Maybe 27, between 26, 27% compounded. If you're making 5% per year, then that is 60% non-compounded, over 70% compounded.
So, what's five steps that you'd give, well, five, you've already given us steps, but tips you'd give people? Five simple tips that you give people to get started in trading.
Get in touch with me. Get in touch with me. Get in touch with me. That's three. Again, I don't think that I'm a good fit for everybody. That's why I still will have a conversation with somebody before they join Star Trading, because we're very protective of our community.
Yeah.
One of the best compliments I ever had about Star Trading was that there doesn't seem to be any dickheads. And I was like,
there's a lot of them about.
There's a lot of them about, yeah. So we try and weed them out before they even start. So I will always have a conversation with people before they join, just to make sure that they're a good fit for us and we're a good fit for them. Whoever you want to get educated from, have a conversation with them. If you want to just get involved with trading, then get education. I remember that course I did 9 and a bit years ago. I went there with one of my best mates. I decided to move forward. He decided to try it by himself.
He's still not done.
No.
I think that's a valid point, that if you've got to look at why you want to do stuff. Yeah. I think it's so important that you do that. Because there's so many people that I speak to, obviously, that in the world of property, that I often, 90% of the calls, do you really want to get into this? Because my background is, my background is debt recovery, and then went into property, but I started in service accommodation. All of the time, do you really want to get into this? Because this is what it's going to take.
Yeah.
Fucking hell, you put me off.
Yeah.
Well, I'm not going to sit here and lie to you. It's not what they promote on these, I won't name them, one day elevator pitch fucking fest that I'm not going to go and speak at, because it's a load of, excuse my French, bollocks. Because that's what it is. They're trying to go, right, I'm going to G you up and then pitch you, and then you're going to sign up and then get, it's graft. You need to know the ins and outs, how to run a business.
Yeah.
And that's what you will learn. But it will take
work. Property graft is harder graft than trading. Like, it is tough.
It's harder than running a debt recovery business.
Oh, wow, yeah. Yeah.
It really is.
And I can believe that.
It really is, because you've got... I say that, working with local authorities is tough.
Mm-hmm.
Because they're local authorities. But property, you just... so much uncertainty there.
Yeah. And so many moving parts.
Yeah, as you know. But yeah. I mean, again, there's another podcast on its own. It's just property. But we won't bore people with it because we've spoken about it before. But one thing that I do find fascinating, because I've never spoken about the trading aspect of it, do you use competition to build your business?
I don't know if I do. I don't think so. There's obviously is competition out there.
Yeah.
I think I'm just quite focused on doing what we do really well. I think I've definitely taken lessons from. I mean, at the end of the day, I was trained by my own competition back in the day. I've definitely adapted and improved things to be a better style of trading for what I wanted, and therefore for a lot of other people as well. I don't know if I think about my competition too much.
The reason I ask is, you're very aware of what you want to achieve, and likewise, like I wouldn't. It doesn't matter about the price point for me. I know that I only allow certain people in there because if they disrupt my community, I don't care what you've paid, you're out.
Yeah.
And you said it already. I was actually going to ask you that question, but you've hit the nail on the head. If you're disruptive, or you break the cycle, then you're not going to be part of this community, and it's not right for you.
Yeah.
So that's why I ask, because ultimately you're trying to build a community of like-minded people and help them get to from where they are, obviously, to where they want to be.
Mm-hmm.
And I can see, certainly with other people on social media promoting trading, it's I'll get rich quick in
a
certain amount of time, and it puts people off. I mean, I've seen it on Instagram, for example. This is how you get there, do this on Forex, and you just report it as spam, like, get off my feed, it's annoying.
Yeah.
But you've never seen that from yourself?
No, because I don't believe in that. I don't believe in get rich quick. I don't believe in selling people a pipe dream.
Mm.
And I just believe in honesty and integrity.
Yeah.
And I think my ethos behind what I do with Star Trading and the way that we teach and mentor people, and I've got an amazing head coach, we've got an amazing community who are all supportive and fantastic. But what our ethos is to empower people. And if you're telling them it's get rich quick and it's not, you automatically disempower them.
Mm.
But we're also going to be attracting the wrong type of people if we say that. Mm. Because we don't want the get rich quick crowd, because they actually don't have much backbone. They don't have much stamina. They don't have the perseverance to continue. Or they're just a bit naive. None of those things is people I really want to work with.
Mm.
So. And why I don't want to work with them isn't because I don't have compassion on where they're at, it's because they're not going to make a success of what I'm trying to give them. And you get a lot of signal services and people who will want to take your money to trade for you. I've never seen that go well. I've actually never seen either of those go very well. The only people that I've seen make money from that are the people offering those things. So I don't offer a signal service. I offer you a service which teaches you to find your own trades. And based upon data and research and analysis, which you can do very quickly, but based upon what the market has performed over at least 3 years, and therefore is more likely going to continue doing as it performs as well.
So if anyone listening is now, how much would it cost to get started, or how much would you need to get started in trading? So if you've got, say, £5,000, £10,000 in the bank, would you not advise, because it's not financial advice, how much would you say someone would need in their account to get started with trading today?
So this is one of the things I love about trading. With the brokers that we recommend in the UK, they are FCA regulated, so your money's protected. That's the most important thing. You don't have to use our broker. I say our broker, the one that we recommend.
Mm.
You can use any broker you want, but just make sure they're FCA regulated, because then your money's protected up to like £80,000 or whatever it is. Beyond that, in terms of putting money into your account, regardless if you've got £5,000, £10,000, £1 million, no more than a maximum of £1,000. You can start with as low as £300 to £500 with the broker that we recommend, but yeah, no more than £1,000 when you first start off.
And your what's your company called?
Star Trading.
Brilliant. And they can get in contact with you on your social media?
Yes, yeah, so I'm on Instagram a lot of my life. So if you want to see pictures of Chinese food, then it will be on there. And be careful with that, because there is a few fake accounts of me as well. So remember, I will never take your money for the purpose of trading. I'll take your money to teach you. I'm very happy to do that.
Yeah.
But yeah, so my Instagram is @Lewis_Crompton. spelled correctly, but I'm assuming you'll put it in the show
notes. I definitely will. I've still got a few more questions that I want to ask. Do you think your diary is a reflection of your self-love?
Oh, I've seen this coming around, yeah.
Because I asked Dee that.
Yeah.
And I think it's such a good question.
It is a really good question, yeah.
I guess as well.
Yeah. And me and Dee were actually, well, I was speaking at one of Dee's events in Dubai a month or so ago, and we were on a panel, and I think a similar question came up, and I think Dee gave a really good answer there. I can't remember what it was, but I think it was good. But do I agree with that, if I'm honest with myself, do I agree with that? Yes, I think I do, yeah. Because one thing that I think is really, really important as busy people is that we use our diaries as a tool. So if you want to get something done, it has to be in your diary. So I've put time into my diary to spend time with my loved ones. Now, my other half struggled with that, got really annoyed, like, why are you having to diarize me? You should just spend time with me. Well, I'm actually showing you love because I'm valuing you enough to carve out time to make sure it happens.
How do you then, because you've worked on yourself up until this point now, how do you communicate that to your loved one? This is a lesson from me, for me.
Yeah, yeah, it's still a lesson I'm learning. And I don't always get it right, definitely not.
That's a very hard skill.
It's a very hard skill, especially in like in a heated moment.
Yeah.
I think one of the things I try to do is be as calm as possible and try to not make it a big deal. So I try to avoid the, hey, we need to have a chat about this. I try and avoid that. And I think one of the things that has helped is just demonstrating that this is helpful for me. So I say, would you mind if we do it this way? Because that would be really helpful for me. Because, but then genuinely say, does that work for you? Does that not work for you? Because, yeah. I think you can sometimes come into conversations thinking too much about yourself and not about the other person.
Absolutely.
And you have to allow them, because what I found is I've done a lot of thinking because I overthink. So I've thought about the consequence of this, I've thought about the consequence of that, but I've not allowed the other person to be on that same journey and process. So you have to learn how your other half, if it's a conversation with your other half, but it could be a conversation with a business partner, how do they operate? My other half does not come up with answers to questions like that. They do not externally process like I do. So I have to say something, give my thoughts on it, and then retreat. And then allow.
I can still resonate with that now, yeah, as well.
And then allow that to come back. But I've also gotten better at saying, we still need to have that conversation and come to a decision on that. So I know you need time to think about that, but we need to know by this point. So you've got from now until then, which is more than just 20 minutes, because they need more than that. But if they need a few days, they need a few days.
Is it taking you a while to get to the point where it's not black and white and they need more than 24 hours?
Yeah, it has taken me a while, yeah. But I think it's taken them a while to get to the point where I am what I am and I operate the way that I operate, and that's not going to change either.
No, and it's I suppose, and I can only go by myself on this, you're continuously going to be working on it, and as we said earlier, you'll always be working on that to some degree. And I think, I always relate back to business, when you work with people in business, there's going to be differences, no matter what. And then you've got to say, like you've just correctly said there, in my opinion, that people work in different ways, but again, you've got to say, right, how does that work for yourself? And then you've got to set the boundaries from the very beginning, because you don't want to be crossing lines or overstepping boundaries, more to the point.
Yeah.
But again, with your spouse, you've got to say, if that works for you, great. And then come back and retreat if that's your way. If it's not, that's where the communication or lack of, rather, could potentially become an issue. And it's certainly something I'm working on and becoming better at. It's not by any stretch one of the best of my skill sets.
Yeah.
Anyone I've spoken to, like I said, doesn't matter how much they earn, they're still working on that one skill set. But yeah, no, it's fascinating that is probably the biggest skill set that people work on is communication.
Yeah, because there is a fine line between too much communication, overly communicating, and not communicating enough.
Yeah,
I would rather err on the side of over communicate, but that can also be damaging as well. Like if I was to tell my other half all of my innermost thoughts all the time, I don't think that's helpful or healthy for a relationship either.
So what would you not tell her?
Well, if you're walking down the street and you see something that's pretty nice looking, you don't have to necessarily comment on that. Like that's for your own head and your own thoughts later on. That type of thing, or just if you, for example, if you're having doubts about your relationship, but you know it's because your head's in a weird space for whatever reason, I don't need to communicate that necessarily. If I'm having doubts about my relationship because of something specific they're doing, then I would maybe address that thing that they're doing and see if that can be worked on. But if I'm just having, I mean, I probably have doubts about my relationship, don't listen to this, probably like once a week, because that's just how my, because that's how my brain, I am an overthinker, so I'm constantly going through all connotations and consequences of everything in my head all the time. That doesn't mean I'm not in love, that doesn't mean that I don't want to be with that person, but I will, my brain will entertain the thought of, is this the relationship you want to be in? And so it goes on that journey probably once a week.
Are you an overthinker or nervous due to the upbringing you've had and potentially not feeling, this is an assumption, not feeling enough love from parents?
I would say my parents definitely did show me enough love. I just don't think I was able to receive it because of stuff that I've been through. Like my parents are incredibly loving, incredibly accepting, incredibly, all of that wonderful, wonderful stuff. Very, very supportive. Even if they don't understand, my mum still doesn't know what I do. I mean, she knows, I've told her a million times, but she's like, I don't understand what you do. But they're very supportive at the same time. So I would say it's more, I think I do overthink from a nervous disposition, which may be genetic, because my mum's got a bit of a nervous disposition. Could be from everything that I've been through. But again, I think you kind of get to the point where I try not to let my past, my history, my story dictate who I am. And I just kind of have accepted, well, this is kind of how I am and how I operate. Things which are particularly unhealthy, I work on to change and improve. But my overthinking is also a gift a lot of the time. And I don't mind that. I just have to manage it in certain contexts. And one of the ways I manage my anxiety at the moment is I've become militant and aggressive with gratitude. And people always say gratitude is so important. Do you like gratitude in the morning? It's like, no, fuck that. Like, gratitude in the morning does not help me. It doesn't. When I've discovered for the past month where I've been using this technique, I say technique, I just made it up one day, and I'm sure it's nothing new. But the second I feel anxious, I've turned that anxious feeling into a trigger to become thankful about everything I can think of in that moment. And so it's like the enemy of anxiety turns up, I just start machine gunning it with gratitude straight away.
Do you know what? It's exactly the same as me. But in any situation, in any social situation, really. Again, I've spoken about this. You could get on the train up here, because here, obviously, we've got train strikes now. We get it. I always get that. Doesn't matter what setting I'm in.
Yeah.
But through coping mechanisms that I've obviously developed, I'm like, well, at least I'm here.
Yeah.
I couldn't. There's certain situations where I wouldn't have been here. So I'm grateful that I'm here. Right, okay, but how long until the next stop? Well, and then my brain will go into overdrive. Yeah. Shut up. This is how you're going to do it. And this is what you're going to do. This is how we're going to play this out, and so on and so forth. But then I will start aggressively going into, this is why I'm grateful. This is what I'm grateful for. And this is why I'm grateful that you're going to be coming on the podcast today, because you're going to share your story. It's going to help someone. Before I know, I'm at the next stop.
Yeah.
It's very, very simple practice to implement in your daily routine that doesn't cost a thing. You don't have to get up and start writing 10 lines every morning. It's a load of bollocks. It's not a load of bollocks to some people. It doesn't work for myself.
Yeah.
Well, obviously, it doesn't work for you. But if you experience any type of anxiety, that works for me.
Yeah, exactly.
And I may not experience it on the way home.
Yeah.
But I might experience it.
And the other thing about that, which I love as well, is you're not letting your knowledge of the fact you can respond to certain situations that way, as in get anxiety, stop you from going into those situations.
Whereas I used to.
Yeah.
And I used to say, oh, Gemma, can you, with my ex-wife, can you come into London? Or can you, for example, go into an area with me? No, not anymore.
Yeah.
And that's why I feel more confident.
Yeah.
hence the start of the whole podcast, the whole meeting people. Because the property business has been going for over 3 years. I've only done this in the last month.
Yeah.
Obviously, it's grown to where it is now. But that's really it. And that's why I love doing what it is. I've always loved meeting people, but never had the real confidence, if you like, to actually do it. I mean, I actually love it. But let's have a look. What else have I got for you, man? I want to get this out. What's the biggest thing you've been wrong about in the last year?
Biggest thing I've been wrong about in the past year. Careful about what I say here. Biggest thing I've been wrong about in the past year. Okay, I'll go for this one because it's slightly safer. So I went into business with a guy a couple of years ago, and turned out the whole business was a scam. So he had initially, and I knew him, I was friends with him, I'd been to a wedding with him, like he was in a mutual friend's wedding, we got on really well, all of that sort of stuff, blah 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 blah. This particular business venture, he'd actually asked the friend who was getting married, who was our mutual friend, to also invest in this business, but it wasn't the right time for her, so she didn't. So he then came to me and I was like, yep, sure, okay, sounds good. I've got a bit, but it was to do with clothing. I have a background in retail, so I can really help and add some value here. So I was gonna go for it. Invested £10,000 to like get some of our initial stuff in place and materials and things like that. And then it just all kind of disappeared and turned out it didn't exist. All the orders and stuff that I've been sent didn't exist. There was no orders. It turned out he'd scammed somebody else out of more money with the same fake orders and things like that, which taught me a massive lesson about how to actually do due diligence. Because if I just called up the people who'd supposedly made those orders, they'd be like, no, that doesn't exist, and I would have known straight away. But I didn't even do that. And I fought him for 3 years to get that money back. And it was this year, I was speaking to a friend of mine, and she was like, how much of your energy has that taken from you for 3 years? And I was like, oh shit. And I suddenly realised, as much as it pains me, I just have to walk away from it now. And I've made way more money than 10,000, but it was the principle of it. I'm like, what am I holding on to this principle for? Like, people always say, oh, it's not about the money, it's the principle. Well, how is that serving you? How is my attitude towards this person who is a scumbag and is an awful human being and has 10 grand of my money, how is me holding on to that and constantly, like, once a week sending, chasing messages, getting lawyers involved and everything like that, how is that actually serving me? Again, technically cost and value. That cost me £10,000, but the value it's now taking away from me is even more because I'm allowing it to continue. If I just cut it off as a cost, then it stops taking value away from me.
And it's very important for people to recognise what you've just said there. You cut it off as a cost, but also a lesson to take from that is people will let you down.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't matter in a relationship or your business.
Yeah.
People will let you down, but you've got to be aware that it will happen.
Yeah.
And it might seem harsh to say that, but it's the truth.
Yeah.
But you've, as long as you've put the most in that you possibly can, but just recognise that enough is enough,
mm-hmm.
and then walk away. But you've got to show a lot of awareness to go, enough is enough, and then move on like you've done.
Yeah, and it's tough because in that situation it feels like I'm letting them win.
Yeah.
But I need to let myself win and escape from that situation. And I did send a final email saying, you are a scumbag, you're disgusting, you're an awful human being, all the things which are completely true. And I was like, was that worth £10,000, that email? Probably not, but hey, maybe it's worth one.
Just send nine more. Now, yeah.
Nine more emails to go, but it's fine.
Send them an active campaign,
yeah.
Like one a year. What's the best piece of advice you remember receiving?
Best piece of advice. Oh, that's a really good one. Best piece of advice. Oh, I don't know. Oh, I wish I had like a catalogue of quotes I've been given by people. Probably focus on the numbers, because the numbers don't lie.
You know what, that's the second time we've had that.
Really?
That's the second time we've had that.
And
that's amazing.
So my one of my first entrepreneurial endeavours was a food van. Mm. And I took it to a music festival. And I didn't really know what I was doing. Mm. I made it all happen. I'm very good at making things happen. And I took my savings and I put it into this food van, which I end up hiring. I sort of, I don't know if this is going to be a long-term thing, so I'll hire one, blah, 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 blah. And I just had no idea about the numbers whatsoever. I mean, I catalogued everything and how much things cost. But I remember getting to the end of that event and I lost money. If I had continued with it, it would have made money probably, but I lost money on that one-off event. And I remember going back to it and thinking, oh, if I had of, like, the price I was charging, for example, it was a chip van, basically, like sweet potato fries and normal fries and then different toppings. And I probably ate most of my profits, to be honest, that weekend. But the numbers that I should have, that I remember looking at and thinking, oh, I didn't do a good job there, were the portions I had was a small portion and a large portion. But I was making more money off of the small portion when I actually looked at the sizes of them. But I kept trying to upsell people to the large. I was like, what am I doing? Like, I priced this wrong. And so then I was like, and I was running out of rations and everything, it was a whole mess. But I was like, and I said to one of my team members, like, stop selling the large, just let people have the small, because we actually make more money off of that. So yeah, it was an interesting one. I said, but that taught me as well. And when I got that piece of advice, I was like, oh yeah, because that experience there made me realise that. And if you don't really, really keep an eye on the numbers, then they will run away. And you need to know what they are. On it as many things as possible, and if you can't track it, then you can't change it.
I'll speak to you off air about that, but that's amazing, mate. Well done. What is your biggest regret?
I genuinely don't know if I have any regrets in my life. I genuinely don't think I have any, and that's not from a. Maybe it's from a reframing thing in my brain, but I'm very happy with what my life is and how it's turned out and everything like that. Maybe from practicing gratitude militantly, but I the worst points in my life have formed me into who I am now, so I wouldn't change anything. So if I wouldn't change it, how can I regret it?
I'll reword it. Failure.
Oh, failure. I've had a lot of failures. Again, I wouldn't necessarily change it, but probably one of the biggest failures probably was that flip deal, which we lost 30 grand on from that perspective. I don't know if I've had many big financial failures in that way. My previous relationship was obviously a failure, but it needed to fail. I would actually say that on a personal level, I failed myself so much in that relationship for years after the relationship, because I kept allowing that person to have an influence over my life, and that degraded my sense of self so much that it was hard to get back from that. That's probably one of my biggest personal failures.
Powerful. What's one piece of advice for everyone listening that you want to share with them today?
Know your numbers. One piece of advice would be, don't listen to the gurus. Do what works and makes sense for you, and get an additional income stream, like trading.
Brilliant. And my last one is, are you okay?
I'm okay.
Brilliant. Lewis, it's been a pleasure. Thank you very much for coming on, and thank you, like I said, again, I can't wait to have you on for another one, and I'm sure we will talk about dissecting pretty much everything that you've spoken about, but it's been a pleasure, mate. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me. It's been really good.
Thank you for listening to the Connect You podcast. If you've enjoyed this episode, please share this on your socials, tag me, and leave a review.